All right. It is 1 o'clock. I believe we can start. And I like talking to Richard Shore. We want to thank him. Him and his wife Naomi are sponsoring today's sharing observance of Yahrzeit for his father, Philip Shore,
Thank
Shraya
you.
Mordechai Ben Chaim Dov, and may be blessed with good health and long life. And the power of Torah always connects this world and the next world. So neshama shel Avraham Aliyah, and the good things.
Thank you for sponsoring. That's very special.
Yeah.
Okay, so hello, everybody. We are in number four of our series. This is going to be the last one in kind of the historical progression of the story of the Tanaim. Next week, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take a look at how archaeology helps us to understand very important concepts and ideas in the Mishnah. And we're going to also do a little connection to Pesach because we're getting close to Pesach. So that's next week. But this week we're going to do our last generation of the Tanaim. So and before we, you know, switch to the world of the Amoraim, before the rabbi switched to the world of the Amoraim. So we are going to talk about Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and the redaction of the Mishnah, okay? And what we're going to do is, first of all, last time we spoke about the trauma of the Bar Kokhba revolt and the aftermath, right? The generation of the survivors, rebuilding the Torah world, rebuilding Smicha, the different reactions that people had to the traumas of Bar Kokhba. By the time we get to Rebbe, right, generation number five of the Tanaim, things have stabilized somewhat. We have a more friendly Roman Empire, as we're going to see. And yet Rebbe feels very strongly the weight of history on his shoulders. And he understands the need to make more order in the oral law. Okay, and very important, I'm writing here the redaction or the editing of the Mishnah, not the writing down, as we're going to see. It is not written down, but it is organized. It is categorized in a form that will continue until today. So we're going to explore a little bit of who was Rabbi Judah the Prince, what did he do, where did he live, right? We're going to spend a lot of time talking about two different places, Beit Sha'arim and Tzipori, Rebbe's two residences, and they are also two of the residences of the Sanhedrin. The picture you're looking at, which is really such a great picture, right, and you should be able to read it, even if your eyes are good, right? Starting on the right, of course. Shalom haperot halalu asurim v'beit she'an b'shvi'it u'bishar shavua, etc., etc. This is an amazing mosaic. Okay, we're going to see other mosaics as we go on today from the synagogue in Tzipori that are very visual, that are much prettier. This isn't very pretty, but it's fascinating. This was a mosaic that was discovered in a community in the Beit She'an Valley called Tel Rehov, a community that was prominent in biblical times and then later also in Mishnaic times. And this is a mosaic that was in the local synagogue, but not for decorative purposes, but for informational purposes. It basically tells you which cities are included in the mitzvot ha-tzluyot ba'aretz, which cities have to give maaser, which cities are included in the laws of Shemitah, right? And this is hanging on the wall, like some, you know, halachic statement by the Rav, blown up and put up on the wall. Why did I put this here? Because it is one of the very few examples that we have of a written down Braita. This is called the Braita of Tchumen, right? Tchumen as in the Tchum of Eretz Israel, the boundaries of the land of Israel. But it's one of the few examples we have of Mishnah or Braita written down. And that's, we're going to come back to that. So I chose that as the beginning of our picture. Okay, so where are we? Last time we spoke about the first two stops of the Sanhedrin in the north, which were Usha, okay? Usha, not so far from Haifa, okay, slightly north here, and Shfaram nearby. Now the Sanhedrin is going to move to stops number three and number four, okay? Beit Sha'arim and Tzipori. As you can see, they are not very far from each other, okay? By car, like 20 minutes, walking a little bit longer, right? But they are really very close to each other. They are very different types of cities. As we're going to see, Rebbe's original home is Beit Sha'arim. but he eventually moves to Tzipori because Tzipori was healthier. Rebbe was not a well man. He had a lot of stomach issues. Beit Sha'arim, and it's interesting today, if you travel from one to the other, right, which a lot of people do, they'll go on a tour to go to both these places because they're very close to each other and the story is very connected. Beit Sha'arim is down in the valley. Right, it's in the Jezreel Valley. It's down low. It's rather warm. It's not always the most comfortable. It's a beautiful place, but it's not always the most comfortable place. Drive 20 minutes, and you're in Tzipori, which, as we're going to see, the Gemara says it's Birosh HaHarim Kimot Tzipor. It's high up in the mountains like a bird, right? And that's why the air is better, because you're high up. So two different climates, topography, also very different kinds of cities. We're going to see Beit Sha'arim is much smaller, much more homogeneous as far as we see, right? It's mostly Jewish. Again, not that much has been excavated, so we don't know 100%, but it seems like it's much more of a Jewish town. Tzipori is much larger. It is a very cosmopolitan town. We can tell both from the archaeology as well as from references, lots of references in the Gemara to Tzipori. We hear about it all the time, that it's a very mixed town. Besides the Jews, there are pagans, there are Jewish Christians. Later on, there are real actual Christians, right? And it's a much more complicated place. Just to touch on two other places while we have this map in front of us, okay? The final stop of the Sanhedrin, right? If you remember way back to the very first session, we talked about the famous Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that talks about the movement of the Sanhedrin, right? After it leaves Jerusalem, it goes to Yavne, and then it comes up north, and we have five stops in the north: Usha, Shfaram, Beit Sha'arim, Tzipori, and finally we have Tiberia, Tiberias, okay? And the Gemara says, Utiberia, Amuka. Wow, you don't like to write, to draw. Tiberia amukahi mikulam. Tiberia is the lowest one or the deepest one, right? Which is true on a simple level. It is the lowest one topographically. It's down in the valley, but it's the deepest as in the idea that the Masorah resides and stays in Tiberia for centuries afterwards. Okay, so that's, we talked a little about Tiberia last time with Rabbi Meir. We're not really going to touch on it today, but it's important to understand that from Tzipori, the Sanhedrin moves to Tiberia, and that's the time of the Amoraim already, and Tiberia has centuries upon centuries of rabbinic tradition. Okay, the other place I would point out here is Caesarea, okay, on the coast. Caesarea, also big, important city. Tiberia isn't a big, important city, but much more of a homogeneous Jewish city. Caesarea is a very Roman city with a Jewish population. Okay? Beit Sha'arim and Tzipori, literally in the middle, okay, physically in the middle, but also spiritually a little bit to a certain extent in the middle as well. So we're going to start by looking at Beit Sha'arim. An understanding about Beit Sha'arim. And we're looking at this handsome gentleman on the horse because he's really the first person who discovers Beit Sha'arim. And this is somebody named Alexander Zaid. He is a member of the first group of Jewish self-defense in 1800 years, right? Last time we talked about how Bar Kokhba revolt turned the rabbis against Jewish self-defense. And it's not until we get to the early 20th century that we have Jews who come to the land who say, we have to defend ourselves. We can't rely on Arab guards. And they create an organization called Hashomer, right? The guardian, the watcher, in a place called Kfar Giladi in the far north. Alexander Zaid is one of the members of the Shomer. And he goes in 1926 to an Arab town called Sheikh Abrech, right, in the Jezreel Valley to defend the area because there are a lot of Jewish farms nearby. And he's the first one to discover that Sheikh Abrech is actually built on the remains of an ancient town. Later on, we discovered from an inscription in one of the graves that it's Beit Sha'arim, but he already sees it's something big, it's something important, and he says it should be excavated. Tragically, he is murdered in 1938 in the course of his duties. He's murdered by an Arab terrorist, but his statue is still there on the horse overlooking the archaeological site of Beit Sha'arim. Now, this is what Beit Sha'arim looks like in 1936, right? So Alexander Zaid had some pretty sharp eyes to understand that there was something worth seeing. I always love looking at pictures like this where you see what it was before. And anybody who's been to Beit Sha'arim will see some of the pictures today of how it was excavated. It always boggles the mind what is hiding underneath the ground. But really, there was very little there. And then two archaeologists come along, right? Two of the earliest Jewish archaeologists who build very prominent careers, but this is one of their first excavations, Nachman Avigad and Binyamin Mazar. Both of them very young here, okay? They're in their 30s. Not in this picture, Nachman Avigad is older, but when they're actually excavating, they both become famous later in life because of excavations that they do in Jerusalem, actually. Binyamin Mazar excavates by the southern wall, right? Right near the Kotel, the walls around the Temple Mount. And Nachman Avigad is in charge of the excavations in the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem after the Six-Day War. But they start out in this excavation here in Beit Sha'arim. And they discover a little bit of the town. But one of the things that's fascinating about Beit Sha'arim is that we don't have so much of the town. Now we're doing more excavations on the town, but still there's a lot that could be excavated. The main thing that people come to see when they come to see Beit Sha'arim is not the town, but the burial caves, what's called a necropolis, right? A city of the dead, because that's really what it is. Okay? Rebbe is buried in Beit Sha'arim, and everybody wants to be buried next to Rebbe. So you have this fascinating city of the dead, which we're going to come to in a minute. But first, let's take a look just a little bit at what's been excavated from the city. And like I said, not so much. But in the last 10 years, there has been an excavation in Beit Sha'arim. Actually, we'll come back to this. Let's look at this picture first, because this gives us a little bit more of a sense. As you're driving into the site, this is not even in the national park, this is on the outskirts, you can see some of what they've excavated. And what they found basically is a wealthy, well-planned town, a town that clearly is strongly Jewish. Okay, they found a mikvah, they found a lot of stone vessels. Stone, Jews worry about purity and impurity. Stone doesn't become impure, so that's always a good sign that Jews are here. It's a town from the first century before the Common Era until the fourth century, at which point it kind of falls apart, okay? And we know that Rebbe lives in Beit Sha'arim because we have this Gemara in Sanhedrin that gives us locations of the different rabbis. It says, follow this one to here, follow that one to there, follow Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi to Beit Sha'arim. This is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's hometown. Okay, now if you look at the name, it's an interesting name, right? Beit Sha'arim, the house of the gates. Now in First Temple times, in biblical times, city gate, city wall, very, very common thing. Later on, city gates are less common. Okay? It's more, cities are more open. It's less likely to have an official city gate, but the archaeologists think that they found the gate, right? This is definitely looks like a gate, right? The indentations for the posts that you would put in here to close the door, and perhaps that's what gave the city its name, okay? But the other thing that they found that's exciting, it's very exciting, in fact, is the large structure that you're looking at here. Okay, this structure is a nice, long, narrow rectangle, what we call a basilica structure. Okay, a basilica could be the town hall, it could be a church, or it could be a synagogue. And the question is this the synagogue? Was this the synagogue of Beit Sha'arim? Maybe. We haven't really found. We haven't found a mosaic that has a menorah on it or a carving with Hebrew writing. We haven't found anything that proves it, but it is the main building that's been excavated so far. So perhaps this is the Beit Knesset of the town, or even more intriguing, perhaps this is the Beit Midrash, right? Perhaps this is the study hall of the town, in which case this is the place where Rabbi Judah the Prince and the Sanhedrin sit and convene and discuss the laws. So again, like I said, we haven't found any real clues yet. Who knows? So who is Rabbi Judah the Prince? First of all, what does it mean, the prince? Right? The Nasi. It's much better in Hebrew than in English. The prince sounds like, I don't know, he's in a Disney movie. The Nasi is the head of the Sanhedrin. Right? He's the head of the Sanhedrin, a position that is inherited in most cases. Rabbi Judah the Prince is descended from Hillel, right? Hillel, and we have Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, right? A number of Gamliels. And then we have Rabbi Yehuda. In Rebbe's time, by the way, we start to have mentions of the fact that the household of the Nasi is actually descended from King David, right? So we have this idea that the Nasi is not just a learned man who's the head of the Sanhedrin, but he's a form of royalty, Right. And this is a fascinating thing because scholarship takes the place of priesthood, takes the place of royalty. Right. But Rebbe is not only, as we're going to see in these statements, very righteous, very learned. He's clearly very learned. He's also very wealthy. Now, he's very wealthy. He's very sophisticated. He has friends who are Roman officials. He's even, according to the Gemara, a very good friend with a Roman emperor. And we'll come back to that in 1 second. But let's take a look at some of these sources. We have so many sources about Rebbe, it's hard to choose. All right, we have this Gemara in Kiddushin. A master said, Rabbi Akiva died, Rebbe was born. When Rebbe died, Rav Yehuda was born. When Rav Yehuda died, Rabba was born. When Rabba died, Rav Ashi was born. This teaches a righteous man does not depart from the world until another righteous man like himself is created. As it is said, the sun rises and the sun goes down, right? It's a beautiful idea that there's always somebody in the generation who is the great, right? The person who's going to keep the generation going. And that's Rebbe in his generation, okay? Rabba, the son of Rava, or some say Rav Hillel, the son of Ravalas, also said, between Moshe and Rebbe, we do not find one who was supreme both in Torah and in worldly affairs. And we see this in a lot of different places, that Rebbe is not just brilliant in Torah, but he's very involved in the community, in economics, in feeding people, right? In dealing with the power and the responsibility that comes with his position, as well as with his wealth. Okay? And one more statement from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, right? Rav said, and here we're discussing who is the Messiah, right? If he is of the living, it would be our holy master, i.e. Rebbe. And if he is the dead, it would have been Daniel, the most desirable man. So meaning Rebbe is someone who would be considered even fitting to be the Messiah. Now, we know that he's wealthy, right? We have statements, lots of places in the Gemara. It seems he gets gifted lands from the Romans, right? So he has a lot of kind of what we would call state land. He's involved in feeding the poor during years of famine, and he's actually very careful not to feed people who he doesn't feel are worthy, right? It's an interesting concept. And we even have a statement towards the end of his life where he lifts up his hands and he says, Master of the universe, you know that everything I did with these 10 fingers, I did only for you and for your people Israel, right? The only reason I have wealth, the only reason I have power is to help the people of Israel. Now, he's living, again, we're still in the aftermath of Bar Kokhba. We're still in difficult times, even if they're somewhat better. Rebbe tries to help economically. And we have some very interesting statements that he makes. For example, that Breit and Chumen that we looked at the very first slide, Rebbe actually has certain towns that were largely inhabited by non-Jews, and he exempted them from the laws of Trumot and Masro, from the laws of pertaining to agriculture in the land. It's kind of like a tax break, right? I want more people to live in, more Jews to live in Beit Shean, so I'm going to make it easier to live in Beit Shean. You don't have to pay, you know, people who live in Israel know if you live in Eilat, you don't have to pay VAT, right? You don't have to pay the value-added tax. So that's the same idea here. Trying to settle the land by giving economic incentives. Rebbe also discouraged, he believed that Shemitah, that the sabbatical year and all the restrictions on the sabbatical year were only from the rabbis. And he even kind of pushed to have it abolished, but he was opposed. But he's trying to ease the economic burden to a certain extent. One more thing that we know about Rebbe, we have all kinds of fascinating stories about Rebbe's friend Antoninus, right? Antoninus Caesar. The Roman Caesar. Who is this Roman Caesar? We know there is a Caesar named Antoninus, but he predates Rebbe by a good few decades. The Roman Caesar, who's the most likely to be the contemporary of Rebbe, is someone named Caracalla, who actually has a nickname as Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. And is this Rebbe's friend? Are the stories about the two of them all completely accurate? The way the Gemara portrays it, they are contemporaries. They are partners in a lot of polemic conversations. Maybe the most famous story, right, is that Antoninus comes to Rebbe And he comes to him on Shabbat and he tastes the food and he says, oh, this is amazing food. I want to come back during the week and eat the food. And Rebbe is a little nervous and it comes back during the week and the food is not as good. And he says, why isn't the food as good? And Rebbe says to him, there's a tavlin, right? There's a special spice that's called Shabbat, right? And only Shabbat can make things taste as good. So, but the bottom line of the stories is that unlike Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who kind of has to supplicate the Roman emperors, unlike Rabbi Akiva, who goes out against the Roman emperors and their decrees, Rebbe works with the Roman emperor, right? They are contemporaries. They talk to each other. And presumably he also gets things done for the Jews by doing that. So very interesting, very complicated person. Let's go back to Beit Sha'arim for a moment. Hey, in order to understand what's going on in Beit Sha'arim, you have to understand a little bit about burial. As we said, Beit Sha'arim is a massive necropolis. So let's talk about how people buried. First temple times, Bible times, we know the bodies were laid out until they decomposed. And then the bones are placed in what's called a ma'asefa, right? One place that keeps the family bones together. And we've seen this in burial caves, first temple burial caves. By second temple times, there's a different way of doing it. You do the same two-step process, okay? You lay out the body decomposes, but then instead of putting all the bones together, right? Whole family together in one place, everybody's bones are kept separate, right? And that's a fascinating idea. There are those who explain it for external reasons, right? They say, well, this is the, you know, at this point, the non-Jews are doing cremation and putting ashes into individual urns. Jews don't do that. So let's put our bones into individual boxes, right? Others say, no, this is a part of the trend that we have in Second Temple times in general, a growth in individualism, individual prayer, individual study, individual, all sorts of things. I also want my bones to be my bones and your bones to be your bones and everybody's bones are separated. Okay? And we have a lot we have some statements about the halachot of these bone boxes, which are called in Aramaic gluskimaot or deluskimaot, and in English are called ossuaries. Okay? This is a great example of one. I think I showed this in a different lecture that we did about Bayit Sheni. The ossuaries from Second Temple times are very, very simple. Okay? They have, if anything, like geometric decorations. This guy, the only thing he wanted decorating his ossuary is his name and his title. And it's the same over here and over here. He is Simon Bone Hechala, the builder of the temple. Okay? He's one of the builders of the temple. This is what he was famous. He wants to be remembered for. Okay. So here are some halachot we have from Masechet Smachot, right? Lashon Sagi Nahora. We don't want to say it's a Masechet Evel, right? A tractate of mourning. It's a tractate of happiness because it's all about death. Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok said, my father said to me when he died, my son, bury me in the valley and eventually collect my bones and put them in a dluskima, in an ossuary. Do not collect them with your hands. And that is what I did. So here we're really getting the process of what exactly is done, okay? Another halakha, which is fascinating halakha, one does not bury one person beside another and not a body near bones or bones near a body. Rabbi Yehuda said, anyone who can sleep next to him in life is buried next to him in death. Okay, so you could be buried in the same box. We actually have a sarcophagus in Beit Sha'arim that is a mother and a daughter, if I remember correctly, right? You could be buried in the same box as your child, as your spouse, as your parent, not as your neighbor's wife, right? That would be inappropriate. Now, this idea of ossuaries lasts through Second Temple times and for a century or so afterwards. But by the time we get to the post-Bar Kokhba revolt period, we have a different way of burial. And this is an exception. This is Herod's from Second Temple times, but most people were still burying in ossuaries. Herod as a king did something different, but this is what everybody does by the time we get to the period of Beit Sha'arim. And that's a sarcophagus, right? We abandon this idea of two stages. You take the whole body, you put it in obviously a much larger box because it's for the whole body as opposed to just, you know, the length of the longest bone. And you put this whole thing into a cave, right? Into a structure like what Herod had. And that's what we're going to see largely, not only, but largely in Beit Sha'arim, are these sarcophagi inside caves. Hey, not Rebbe, by the way. He's going to be different, but we'll see that in a minute. Just to realize that all of these methods of burial, whether it's a burial cave and all the bones are put together, or it's an ossuary, or it's a sarcophagus, this is all for the richest, right? This is for the 1%. Only the elite can do this. Most people are buried in what we would call today Potter's Field. Okay? Otherwise, the land of Israel would be covered in graves, right? There just would not be room for anybody to go. Right? Kohanim could never step anywhere. It's very clear from the numbers of ossuaries and burial caves that we have found that most people are not buried like this. Now, when you go to Beit Sha'arim, you see, like I said, most of the place is the necropolis, and you see these caves, right? And we're going to explore a few of them. And some of them look just like what the Mishnah tells us a burial cave should look like, right? It's amazing. So we have the Mishnah here in Bava Batra, right? I have to move this so I can read it. If a man sold to his fellow a place in which to make a tomb, or if a man was commissioned by his fellow to make a tomb, he must make the inside of the vault 4 cubits by 6 and open within it 8 niches, 3 on this side, 3 on that side, and 2 opposite the doorway. The niches must be 4 cubits long, 7 handbreadths high, and 6 handbreadths wide, right? The Mishnah in Bava Batra has to codify everything and tell you the rules, because that otherwise it wouldn't be fair. Somebody's hired to make a burial cave, he has to make it the right size. But this, the numbers, how many niches there are where the bodies or the sarcophagi are put, some of the burial caves in Beit Sha'arim actually fit with that. Now, others are much more large and ostentatious. And we have family caves, we have public burial caves. And again, very, very wealthy, filled with sarcophagi. Now, we are already in the period of third, second century, third century, fourth century. Okay? We are no longer in the period of Second Temple times, where we have very, very little imagery. And here we have a wild amount of imagery, okay? Very ostentatious, some of it very pagan, as we're going to see. This is a famous example. This is actually not in Beit Sha'arim. It was found in Beit Sha'arim, and it was brought and displayed in the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem, right? And you can see it's this intricately carved coffin, sarcophagus. I don't know if anybody recognizes the picture, but this is a representation of the Greek myth of Leda and the swan, in case you are unfamiliar with this myth, okay? Zeus, the god Zeus, transforms himself into a swan so that he can seduce and have relations with a human named Leda. Is this appropriate for a Jewish burial cave? I don't know. Clearly, somebody thought it was. Okay? And we're going to see that there are many different types. But what I brought the source here for you from Ketubot is really about the ostentatiousness of it, right? The wealth of it. That just like today, when people, well, this is the correction of Corona, thank God, right? But just like up until a year ago, right? Everybody had to outdo themselves with the fanciest weddings, the fanciest bar mitzvahs. Hey, in the olden days, you outdid yourself with the fanciest sarcophagi, the fanciest burial cave, and that's how you showed that you were keeping up with the Joneses. And we have this great Gemara in Ketubot. Initially, the funeral expenses for the expenditures for the deceased were more taxing for his relatives than his death, until it reached a point where people would abandon the deceased and flee. It was too embarrassing. You didn't want to bury someone in a way that wasn't fitting, so you would just run away. And how do you stop such a thing? Well, in a good community, what happens is the rabbi comes along and sets an example. This continued until Rabban Gamliel came and conducted himself in a self-decoratory manner, instructing the people that they were to take him for burial in plain linen garments. And all the people conducted themselves following his examples and instructed their families to take them for burial in plain linen garments. It's a very nice Gemara. It clearly was not all the people, okay? Because this is quite post-Rabban Gamliel, and people are keeping up with very ostentatious ways. Now, one of the fascinating things about the necropolis in Beit Sha'arim is, like I said, Rebbe is buried there, and everybody wants to be buried next to Rebbe. And we have so much information when they discovered these caves and they came inside. First of all, you can imagine the archaeologists, their eyes popped out, seeing these treasures everywhere, these elaborately decorated sarcophagi. But not only that, not only in terms of the beauty, but in terms of the information. Okay, we have so many different motifs and inscriptions from all over, and people literally came from all over the Jewish world, as we're going to see. The motifs in the caves range from the very pagan, like we saw Leda and the Swan, or take a look down here. On the bottom left, this is Nike, not the goddess of shoes, but the goddess of swift and winged victory. Okay, so we have something very pagan. We have something very Jewish, right? This beautiful menorah. We have something that could be, kind of part of it. Could work either way. Lions, eagles, all different kinds of animals. But all of these burials, all of these sarcophagi are Jews. Okay, Jews of different persuasions, different flavors. And we know from the inscriptions that they came from all over the Jewish world. Okay, we have inscriptions of Jews from Israel, obviously, from Tadmor or Palmyra, right? Northern Syria over here. Antioch, Yemen, Asia Minor, Transjordan, this inscription over here, which is in Greek. We have inscriptions in Greek, we have inscriptions in Aramaic and in Hebrew. This one says Odysseus of Antiochia. Okay, so people literally came from all over. One of the other things we have is that a lot of people wrote their profession on their sarcophagus, so we know what jobs they had, right? We have a doctor, we have a merchant, we have a sailor, we have a money changer, we have a head of a synagogue, right? All different kinds of things. Now, after we've seen all of these, what about Rebbe? All right, what does Rebbe do? How is he buried? So one of the caves, right? So somewhat of a smaller cave. It's not quite as impressive as this cave of the sarcophagi, which is massive and filled with these sarcophagi. But if you go into a smaller cave, which seems to have been one of these small family caves and not a public cave, and you go all the way to the back, you will see two rectangles kind of dug into the ground. And we have reason to believe that this is Rebbe's grave. Why do we have reason to believe? Well, first of all, we have different statements in the Gemara that tell us about how Rebbe asked to be buried. First of all, he says, Tehei aroni nekuva ba'aretz. I want my coffin buried in the ground, meaning he doesn't want above ground sarcophagus. So that's what we have here. We also have names on rocks in here that are the names of Rebbe's most prominent students. We're going to see that in a minute. And we also have a fascinating structure above the grave that references something that Rebbe said that he wants happening after he dies. So even though this is in a national park, it is probably one of the most authentic of the Kivrei Tzadikim in Israel, right? Of the graves that people should come and pray at. Nobody comes and prays here, right? A lot of tourists come, nobody comes and prays. I come and I if I come with tourists, I like to come and learn a Mishnah here, which I think is a beautiful thing to do on Rebbe's grave. It is almost definitely Rebbe's grave, and yet it is really not considered a place of pilgrimage for various interesting reasons. So we have a long Gemara in Ketubot that discusses the last moments of Rebbe, okay? And a few of the details are going to be very important for us. So if you have this in front of you in the source sheets, or you can print it out later and read it, our rabbis taught when Rebbe was about to depart from this life, he said, "I require the presence of my sons," and then his sons come and he says, I want you to respect your mother, right? And he gives them some directions. And then go to the second paragraph. I require the presence of the sages of Israel, right? The Sanhedrin. So sages of Israel entered into his presence. Do not lament for me in the smaller towns. Reassemble the college after 30 days. Okay, remember that. My son Shimon is wise, Chacham, right? It's not he's wise. It's that he has a position called Chacham. My son Gamliel is the Nasi, right? And Hanina Bar Chama shall preside at the college. So you have three people, two sons and one student who Rebbe appoints and who he doesn't appoint, and the power struggles. That's a fascinating story in and of itself. But remember those names, Shimon, Gamliel, and Hanina. Okay. Rebbe was lying on a sick bed at Tzipori, but a burial place was reserved for him at Beit Sharim, right? Don't we know that Rebbe lived in Beit Sharim? Rebbe was indeed living in Beit Sharim, but when he fell ill, he was brought to Tzipori because it was situated on higher ground, which is what we're going to see in a moment. And then we have really, Rabbi Kalman can talk about this more than I can, but this very important section of the story, which basically talks about end of life and what how you deal with end of life decisions. On the day when Rebbe died, the rabbis decreed a public fast and offered prayers for heavenly mercy. They announced that whoever said that Rebbe was dead would be stabbed with a sword. Rebbe's handmaid, who's a very important character, she's a very learned woman, ascended to the roof and prayed. The immortals desire Rebbe to join them, right? The angels. The mortals desire Rebbe to remain with them. May it be the will of God that the mortals may overpower the immortals, that Rebbe should stay alive. When she saw, however, how often he resorted to the privy, to the toilet, right? He was in a lot of pain, painfully taking off his tefillin and putting them on again. She prayed, may it be the will of the Almighty that the immortals may overpower the mortals, right? She's praying for him to die because he's suffering so much. As the rabbis incessantly continued their prayers for mercy, she took a jar and threw it down from the roof to the ground. For a moment, they ceased praying, and the soul of Rebbe departed to its internal rest. So this is a Gemara that is used to talk about, can one bring life to a stop, and very important end of life issues. Go, said the rabbis to Bar Kafra, and investigate. And he went, and finding that Rebbe was dead, he tore his cloak and turned the tear backwards. He said, the angels and the mortals have taken hold of the holy ark, right? Elim u'mitzokim, right? Took the Aron Kodesh. You can still see this today on obituaries, particularly on signs of Mea Shearim when someone great dies. The angels overpowered the mortals, and the holy ark has been captured. Has he gone to his eternal rest? You, he replied, said it. I did not say it. Right, and then the statement that I told you before, Rebbe at the time of his passing raised his 10 fingers towards heaven and said, Sovereign of the universe, it is revealed and known to you that I have labored in the study of Torah with my 10 fingers and I did not enjoy any worldly benefits, even with my little finger. May it be your will that there will be peace in my last resting place. A bach call echoed, announcing he shall enter into peace, they shall rest on their beds. So it's a very powerful story, a lot of things to unpack in it. But we want to look at it in terms of the place of Rebbe's death, okay? In this cave. Okay? These are replicas, but the real things were found. Okay? They found three stones. One of them said on it, Rav Gamliel. One of them said on it, Anina Hakatan, right? Chanina, Anina, it's the same name. And one of them said on it, Rebbe Shimon. The three people that Rebbe asks to succeed him, those are the names that we have there. And above the grave, right? This is the cave where Rebbe's grave is. And above it, as you can see, okay, there is a no. Okay, there is a place with seats. Okay, take a look up here. You can actually go up there and sit up there above the grave, right? And we believe that this is what we're talking about. There's another Gemara that talks about they established a yeshiva at his grave to study Torah there, right? To come, there's a custom to come and study Torah above the grave. So it seems from all indications that this really is Rebbe's real grave. Now we've come to the end of Rebbe's life, but we still have much more to say about him. So let's go back to the story of the Mishnah. Okay, what's going on in the Mishnah? Rebbe's great accomplishment is to edit the Mishnah. Now the Rambam, right? Hundreds of years later, in the introduction to the Mishnah Torah, he discusses this, right? And what does he say? Our holy master, right, Rebbe, compiled the Mishnah from the days of Moses, our master, till our holy master. No textbook of the oral law for public instruction had been issued, right? Everybody would teach orally. What did Rebbe do, right? He collected all traditional precedents, judicial pronouncements, expositions, and explanations. And from it all, he compiled the book of the Mishnah, out of which he gave public instruction to scholars, and its fame reached to all of Israel, and written copies were made universally. Okay, like I said, we know today it didn't happen then, but eventually it did. The Rambam explains, but why did our holy master thus and did not leave the matter as it was before, right? What was it before? Everybody taught, and the master taught the student taught the next student, right? And it was all however you learned the traditions from your teacher. But Rebbe observed that the number of students continued to decrease. The volume of oppression continued to increase with renewed strength. The Roman Empire continued to spread out its boundaries in the world and conquer, whereas Israel continued to drift aimlessly and follow extremes. He therefore compiled one book, a handy volume for all, so they may study it even in haste and not forget it. And his whole lifetime, he sat together with the members of his tribunal and gave public instruction in the Mishnah. Now, the Rambam is not just saying this as a history lesson, but as an introduction to what he's going to do, right? Because he sees himself as continuing Rebbe's goal here. He sees himself also in a time of trouble, and therefore he compiles his code, which is the Mishnah Torah. But what does Rebbe do, right? We have all kinds of teachings. We know Rebbe Akiva taught his students and everything. His traditions are all passed on by his students. But it's a lot of different collections. None of it is particularly systematic. Along comes Rebbe, and he says it has to be organized, right? And that's where we get the six orders of the Mishnah, okay? Organized so that you want to know something about damages, you want to know something about marriage, you want to know something about Pesach, you will know where to look, okay? It's organized. It also is leaving things out, right? Nothing, not everything is included. We know if you learn Gemara, you know that all over the place, this one brings a braita, right? A statement that's not brought in the Mishnah. We have a composition called the Tosefta, also not brought in the Mishnah. Rebbe leaves things out, but he organizes, okay? Pretty much everyone agrees. Well, actually, let's come back to that for a second. Let's take a look at the six orders, right? And it's fascinating to see the orders, right? Because some of them are clearly not applicable at this point in the life of the nation of Israel. Okay, Zraim, which is probably the least applicable today, except for Brachot. I don't know if the least, but definitely not as useful today as it was then, but then was still being used. Okay, prayers, blessings, tithes, agricultural laws. Okay, Moed, all the laws of Shabbat and the different festivals, very useful today. Nashim, marriage, divorce, Nazarites, oaths, right? Also mostly very useful. Nezikim, probably the one that is most studied by high school students, right? Civil law, criminal law, oaths, courts. And then he includes Kadshim and Tarot, which is fascinating, right? He includes an entire order about the temple. Rebbe is living more than 100 years after the temple has been destroyed. And yet he includes 11 tractates on the temple and another 12 on Tara, on purity, which is still being used, but is not quite as significant as it was in the time that the temple is standing. But this is meant to be a comprehensive list of laws that even if we're not doing them today, we will do them one day. Now, what is it, right? It's an order, but it's not written down. Pretty much everyone in scholarship today, I just had an interesting conversation this afternoon with my neighbor, Dr. Shira Schmidman, who knows everything there is to know about Gemara. And she said the scholarly consensus is that it was not written down, okay? That it was not written down for quite a long time. How do we know this? Okay, and this is from a scholar named Professor Yaakov Zussman, who basically says we have almost nothing that was found that was written. Remember our Bright of Tumen, it's one of the very rare exceptions. In addition, many times in the Gemara, they're not sure of the tradition. They never say, let's go look in the book. They say, let's go ask this one. Let's go ask that one. This one was a student of that one. He'll know. They always are referring to an oral tradition. Also, if you learn Mishnah, you know there are tons of mnemonic devices, right? Four of this, six of that, right? This and not that, right? All kinds of ways of remembering things. They're very concerned about forgetting things. When is it all written down? Probably not until the time of the Gaonim, okay? Hundreds of years after. Why is it not written down? So I am going to defer to Dr. Schmidman, who told me that she thinks that it's because they thought they'd remember it better, which is counterintuitive to us. But by saying it over and aloud, that helps to remember it. So when we talk about Rebbe editing the Mishnah, he's not writing it down, but he is creating this classification that makes it easier to remember and easier to teach and to pass on. Okay, let's spend the rest of our time in Tzipori, which is a beautiful place. Okay, Rebbe moves to Tzipori because of his health. Sipori is a city also, same time, begins around the same time, end of Second Temple times, but it lasts longer. It's around till at least the Muslim conquest. Then there's a Crusader fortress. Then there's an Arab town called Safuria, right? The Arabs kept the name Sipori, Safuria. Rebbe moves there for his health, and this is what the Gemara says. It's called Kitron, is called Tzipori, because it sits on the top of a mountain like a bird at Tzipor. And when you go up there, you have this beautiful view, and the air is good. Despite the health of the place for Rebbe, he considered himself to be an exile when he lived in Tzipori. We have a midrash that talks about how he said that just like Jacob goes down to Egypt for 17 years of his life and is in exile, Rebbe is in Tzipori for 17 years and is in exile. Even though it's 20-minute drive from Beit Sha'arim, but it's a very different style of a city. Hey, Tzipori starts out as a Jewish town. The oldest part of the town, when you come and you see the excavations, the oldest and the least elaborate part of the town is Jewish, and we know that because we see the mikvaot that are there. Hey, as time passes, the city grows and becomes first pagan, and then, like we said, Jewish, Christian, but all different types of people. And we have a lot of different signs of this pagan presence. One of them is something that so far has not been found in Beit Sha'arim, and that's a theater. Right, you can see the theater. The top rows here are the original. The bottom are reconstructed. Theater is very much a Roman, a Greek and a Roman invention. Did Jews go to the theater? Probably. Okay. The rabbis definitely know about the theater. They use terms that are connected to the theater. Okay. They talk about tickets. They talk about places. They're familiar with it. Was the theater a particularly friendly place for Jews? Not really. Okay. Comedies tend to make fun of Jews. Jews are funny. They worship an invisible God. They don't work one day a week, right? Did you go anyway? Yeah, because that's what people did, right? Now, so far in Tzipori, we have not found an amphitheater, right? We have not found a place of gladiator fights. Doesn't mean that it didn't exist, but it has not been found yet. But a theater is also somewhat of a pagan place to go. We're going to see even more pagan things. Fascinating, just discovered about half a year ago. It's so beautiful. Take a look at it. This is this face was on a fountain, okay? And the water came out of the mouth. And this is something that is very clearly discussed in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, idolatry, right? The Gemara talks about partsufot. A partsuf is a face, okay? Partsufot that spray water in the cities. One may not place his mouth on the mouths of the figures and drink because he appears to be kissing the object of idol worship. And this was discovered perfect whole in Tzipori, right? Beautiful. And clearly a sign of Roman influence, pagan influence, and you can understand why Rebbe would feel uncomfortable with such a thing. This is the downtown of Tzipori, okay? The marketplace, the Gemara, like I said, there's a lot of mentions of Tzipori kind of just by the way, right? The rabbis are walking on the street, they're in the market, right? And we hear a lot about the Shuk of Tzipori. There's actually two, the Shuk Elyon and the Shuk Tachton, the upper market and the lower market. So far we've only found one, but it's a pretty impressive one. Right? We found the main streets, the Cardo and the Decumanus. If you look carefully, actually there's a neat thing here. You see it much better when you come in real life, but you can see the wagon ruts along the street on both sides. Okay, you can see the pillars and the mosaics where the stores were. And this is the major street here. And we found all kinds of things here. There were all sorts of people here, meaning there are mosaics. There are mosaics that are plain geometric figures, but there are also mosaics with a very pagan imagery, right? At the end of the Cardo is this house called the House of the Nile, where there's this beautiful, elaborate mosaic that shows the ceremony of measuring the Nile. This was something that was done in Egypt every year because the Nile was worshipped, and you wanted to see how tall the Nile was. And this guy, this little figure, is standing on top of something called a nilometer, right? And there are all kinds of pagan figures there, but also scratched into the pavement, you can see a little menorah, right? A seven-branch menorah. So you really had all sorts of people. We have stories about Roman officials in the Shuk of Tzipori giving out fines. Hey, we have stories about a non-kosher butcher, a Jewish butcher who tried to pass off non-kosher meat as kosher in Tzipori. And we have this great story about Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, hey, who was accused of heresy, right? Heresy meaning Christianity, the beginnings of Christianity. Of course, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus is not sympathetic to the Jewish Christians, definitely does not believe in what they believe in, but he's accused of heresy and he's very distressed. How could he be accused of such a thing? And Rabbi Akiva says to him, maybe you heard something from a mean, from a heretic, and that's why this happened. And Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus remembered he was walking on the main street of Tzipori, and Jacob of Kfar Sachnaya, he's like the classic Jewish Christian in the sources, came and told him some Torah, and it pleased him. Okay, so you really have all different sorts of people. But by the way, the statement that we have where you have two or three people sitting together, they have to have words of Torah between them, that's said in the marketplace of Tzipori. Okay, so you do have different sorts of people here. One of the most striking buildings in the town is a villa where the major room that was discovered is the dining room, the triclinium. We'll talk a little more about that next week when we talk about Pesach and what did Pesach look like in the time of the Mishnah. But the dining room has this beautiful, elaborate mosaic, okay, two parts to it. Around the sides, you have these pictures you can see on the bottom and on the top, right? The people carrying grapes, and here they're drinking. This is from what's called the Bacchanalia, celebration of Dionysus, the god of wine. This is what's in the living room there. There's also a picture of a very beautiful woman made out of a mosaic known as the Mona Lisa of the Galilee. Was this the lady of the house? We don't know. Now, Rebbe, as the most important Jewish leader, definitely had to sit in this living room, right? He had to meet with this wealthy person, whoever he was, because he was clearly a person of money and of influence. How comfortable was Rebbe sitting in this living room? Later on in Tzipori, the Crusaders take over here, okay? And this is a Crusader fortress. Because of its height, the Crusaders always like places that are high up, that they have a great view, they can control the whole area. By the way, just interesting to know, when the Crusaders are defeated by Saladin in 1187 at the Battle of the Horns of Hattin, they are starting out from Tzipori. That's their camp, right? The Horns of Hattin near Tiberias, not far from here, right? So that's the Crusaders. But let's talk about the synagogue, because that's one of the most spectacular discoveries in Tzipori. One of the Gemaras that talks about Rebbe's death, right, Yerushalmi, talks about how there was mourning in each of the 18 synagogues of Tzipori. So far, we've only found one synagogue in Tzipori, and it's not from the time of Rebbe. It's quite a bit later. This is from the 5th century, but it's pretty impressive. It's pretty nice. It has a very simple exterior and a very elaborate interior, which fits with the time period, 5th century. Byzantines are in control. Jews are not in a position of power at all. But when they came inside, they were able to show off and to express themselves. It's also low down, okay? It's below the area of the town. It's even a little below the area of the marketplace. So it's not standing out. It's literally lying low, okay? But when you come in, you're like, whoa, this is pretty impressive, okay? And we have an enormous mosaic. Part of it on the sides is what you have in synagogue mosaics throughout the centuries and still today, only it's not a mosaic, and that's the names of the people who gave the money, always very important. But then you also have the artistic portion, right, which is made up of three parts, okay? And we'll see them each separately, but I just want to show you their position, okay? The top part over here is what this is, okay? And this is images from the temple, menorahs, offerings, bikurim, the first fruits. This is all about the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? The bottom section is the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. Okay? And we'll see why that is important as well. And the middle section is a very beautiful and elaborate zodiac. Okay? So temple, zodiac, Akedah, though, or really the other direction, but that's what you need to keep in mind. What are the different pieces? Let's see them. Okay, so we have this beautiful imagery of the Akedah, right? A lot of it has been erased. We don't have a lot of the picture anymore, but we definitely have enough that we can understand what's going on. Here's Avraham. Okay. Here's his donkey. He's handing the ropes of the donkey to one of the two Na'arim, right? Here's a Na'ar, right? One of the servants, while he goes with Yitzchak up to the top of the mountain. On the top of the mountain, we don't have very much, okay? What do we have? We have the Svach, okay? The tree that the ram is caught in. And probably my favorite detail here, we have two pairs of shoes. Because you took off your shoes when you come into God's presence. That's what's happening up here. Now, why the Akedah? The Akedah is a very classic motif. We're going to see in a minute. I'll show you other Akedot, Beit Alpha. And why would you put that in your synagogue? So we have this statement from Breishit Rabbah. Rabbi Levi said, Avraham Avinu saw the ram leave one bramble and become entangled in another bramble. God said to him, this is how your children will be in the future, entangled in the empires from Babylon to Madai, from Madai to Greece, from Greece to Edom. And ultimately they will be redeemed with the horn of a ram. As it says, God will blow the shofar. All right, this is a very resonant teaching for Jews living under the yoke of yet another empire, the Byzantine Empire, which is identified also with Edom, Rome, and Byzantium, right? But the Akedah is also about God's promise to Avraham, right? Which is also something that resonates with the Jews who are living not in freedom. Now, the most surprising thing, although not particularly surprising, because we see it in other synagogues, okay, like in Beit Alpha on the left here, like in Chamat Tveria on the right, is the scene of the zodiac. Okay? And the one from Tzipori is particularly beautiful. It's got in the corners, I showed you guys a piece of this last time, in the corners, it's got the four seasons dressed as women, right? The winter, spring, summer, fall. Each of them is a woman in a different outfit, okay? Then you have the Galgal, right? The zodiac, the 12 months, each symbol with the name of the month, right? Adar, Dagim, here are the fish for Adar, right? Taleh, the lamb for Nisan, okay? Each one with its month and its name. And in the middle, the most surprising of all, we're going to see more of it in a second, is Helios, the sun god. What is going on here? Okay. I'll just tell the story because I always tell it when I talk about this mosaic because I think it's such a powerful story. I once visited Tzipori with a group of lovely Frum women, and we went in, we saw, we learned, we talked, and it was late afternoon and we were going to get back on the bus. And I said, ladies, let's daven mincha because, you know, it's mincha time and here we are in a shul. And they looked at me like I was insane. We're going to daven here with this stuff on the floor, right? So it's rather disturbing to us. It's rather shocking to us. Certainly when you look at the sun god, right? In Chamat Tveria and in Beit Alpha, you actually can see a figure. In Tzipori, it's a little bit more abstract, okay? There's a chariot, but in the chariot is the sun as opposed to an image. What is going on here? Okay, so you can look at this in one of two ways, right? You could say these are people who are very involved in the pagan culture. This is Byzantine culture, right? It's not pagan anymore. They're living in a Christian world. But this is the culture that's there. This is what they're used to. Byzantine churches also have zodiacs. This was just a classic thing that people did. They were part of this world. And they are going to put these decorations in their synagogue as well. And they didn't see anything strange about that. Now, the excavator of Tzipori explains in a different way, which I think is a more powerful way. And he sees the zodiac as well as the seasons, as well as the sun, all representing God, because you can't really show God. So how do you show God? You show God through his power in the world. And that's what this medrash here in Bamidbar Rabbah says. Merkavto argaman, right? His carriage is purple. There's a pasuk from Tehillim. This is the sun that is placed above and rides in a chariot, okay? The person writing this midrash is very aware of Helios riding in his chariot and lights up the world. As it is said, and he is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. And from the power of of the sun, the rain falls, and from the power of the sun, the earth gives fruit. And therefore, it is called Argaman. Why is the chariot called Argaman? God made it to weave man, la'arog man. For the world, man is fruit and vegetables. And Zev Weiss, the excavator in Tziporit, says this is what's going on in this mosaic here. What you have is you're talking about three things. You're talking about God's promise, right? The Akedah. God promises us that we're going to be a great nation. We're talking about the fulfillment of God's promise. The temple is going to be rebuilt. We're going to come back. Remember, this is Byzantine times. Jews are forbidden to enter Jerusalem. But the temple is going to be rebuilt one day. And how is God going to go from the promise to the fulfillment of the promise? Because God is all powerful. And that's God's power in nature. And that's the zodiac. And that's the symbolism of Helios and of the zodiac. And he says, you come into the shul and you daven Shmoneh Esrei. And what do you say in that first blessing of the Amidah, right? Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu ve'elokei avoteinu, Elokei Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, Hakel Hagadol Hagibor Vanora, right? All powerful God. Zocher chasdei avot, you remember the promises, the good things that the avot did, right? The akeda, umevi goel ibnei b'neihem, and you bring a redeemer to their children. That's the temple being rebuilt. So that's the first blessing of the Amidah in a mosaic form. Okay, one last thing. In Tzipori, one of the things that's exciting about Israel is that there's always something new that's being discovered. And in the north, there's definitely always something new being discovered. There was such a concentration of Jewish settlement in the Galilee and in the Golan that it's hard not to discover new things. Right next to the National Park of Tzipori is the village of Tzipori, right? It's a Jewish town since 1948. And in this Jewish town, there is a guy named Mitch Pilser who has B&Bs. He has a Zimmer, right? A little vacation village. And about 10 years ago, he wanted to expand and he wanted to make a pool. And as he was digging the hole for the pool, he came across this very nice door to a burial cave. And on the door was an inscription, right? Which said, this is the grave, Zehu Kivro, Shel Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi Kapra or Safra. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi is one of the most important of the Amoraim, okay? A couple generations after Rebbe. Is this really his grave? We have a little bit of a problem because when Mr. Pilser called the Atra Kadisha, the people who protect ancient graves, and said, listen, I don't want, you know, this to be taken away to museum. Will you help me keep it here? They said, well, it's very nice. We'd love to help you. But since the Gemara says that Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi lo mat, right? He never died. He's one of the few who enters heaven alive. This can't be his grave. So they didn't help him, but he managed to win his battle and he managed to keep the door there. And if you go to Tzipori, you can go and see this. Now it's not a pool. The pool was built next door. And this is just one of the things that was discovered accidentally. And there are certainly many, many more treasures waiting underground for us to find. Okay, so let's take a look at some questions that we have here. Okay, Marcus Aurelius was known as the philosopher king, right? The problem is that we don't know that there are a few people who are possibly Marcus Aurelius. But yes, it would make sense that he would have a relationship with Rebbe, and that is definitely the direction that the sources are going in, that they have these philosophical conversations. Okay? Is the friendship between rabbis and emperors attested to in Roman sources? Not really. Okay? They don't write about us quite as much as we write about them. Rebbe's handmaid had power and authority. I don't know if she had power and authority. I wouldn't go that far. She was smart. She was educated. Right, we have this great story where the rabbis don't know what a Hebrew word means. Right, lisalsel bisaro. Right, Yosef is like fixing his hair. They don't know what that word means, and they go to Rebbe's maid, and she tells them. Right, so she spoke this beautiful Hebrew, but yeah, she doesn't have a name. Welcome to the world of women in the ancient world. The jar that the handmaid shattered caused the shock, right? I don't know if it's a shock. It seems to be, and again, this is end of life issues. It stops the rabbis from praying, and that's considered to be like comparable to stopping life support. Am I correct in that, Rabbi Kalman? I think that's how it's looked at, right?
It's like, yeah, I mean, she got them to stop praying, and then he died. And many poskim assume halacha lemaisa, when somebody's very sick, you can pray for them to die. Some say it's forbidden to say tehillim. This has come up at some of the medical ethics conferences we've had, that someone's very sick. Sometimes you're not supposed to pray for them to get better. They're suffering. Absolutely. This is quoted in halacha lemaisa often, this story.
But it's not that he was shocked and he died, but that they stopped praying, meaning
right,
the life support was cut
she
off.
She threw the thing on the floor, and the rabbis were startled. They heard this big noise, so they all, you know, they all looked up. And then that moment, you know, whatever, literally whatever, within that moment, they stopped happening, and, you know, that's it. He died, and then the poskim say she was right, and the students of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi were not.
All right. What were the relative contributions of Akiva, Meir, and Judah in collecting, organizing, and editing the Mishnah? So we have, and we talked about this last time or two times ago, we have this very famous statement that says, you know, Stam Mishnah is Rabbi Meir and Stam Breita. Everyone has, if it's not attributed, then it's attributed to one of these greats. But all of them, Vakulhu Aliba de Rabbi Akiva, and they all come from the school of Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva is definitely teaching, and Rabbi Akiva is one of the earlier ones of these categorizers. Right, we have this great Gemara that says that Rabbi Akiva was like a person who comes home with all his stuff from the marketplace, and then he puts it each into its proper place. Right, the fruit goes here, and the vegetables go here. He brings home all this learning, and he puts it each in its proper place. So it's not that Rebbe does everything; he is building on existing collections of halachot, but he creates the definitive collection. And again, this is a whole discipline which people know much more about than I do. Rebbe's death is a basis of Jewish medical ethics, right? That's what we were talking about. An oral culture, 100%, right? And ask anybody, you know, we don't, in our world, we really don't know people like this. But if you talk to, let's say, Yemenites, old Yemenite grandparents, right, who had to study from one Torah scroll, 10 children, right? Of course, they learned things by heart. How much longer do they keep the laws of Torah? That's a fascinating question. Clearly, there were Kohanim kept eating Truma B'Tahara for generations. How much did everybody keep it? It's definitely discussed a huge amount in the Mishnah and the Gemara. Does that mean everybody was doing it? It seems for at least a number of generations after the temple is destroyed. And when you go to Susia, for example, which is much later, it's a good couple hundred years later, you have more than 30 mikvaot. So people are clearly concerned about Tuma and Tara. Rebbe may have lived in the Dionysus house. Yes, I have heard that suggestion. To me, it seems exceedingly unlikely. But if there was a professor who says it, I can't say it's untrue. I will just say I don't like it. Are there any books with pictures? Yes, there are lots of books with pictures. How many of them are in English? That's a great question. Send me an email and I will see what I can find for you. Okay, Susanna says they didn't have problems with pictures of women. Okay, so this is another very interesting question. Is the women is hardly the major issue here. I have much more problems with Helios than with the women, right? But the question is, who's asking? Is anybody asking the rabbis, right? Are we assuming that everybody's listening to the rabbis? Are some people listening? Are the rabbis not going into the synagogue? Maybe they don't feel so comfortable, right? Don't assume that everything is just like what the rabbi said there should be. Are there Tanaim? No, Rebbe is the last generation of Tanaim. And after him comes Amorim, with a few interesting exceptions like Rav, who's considered to be a Tana, even though he's really the time period of the Amora. Okay, King David, again, the same idea. What resources are there for more academic study of the Mishnah? You would have to go to someone who is much more academic than me. So I will not answer that question. I don't have great answers for you. I mean, there's like, you know, there's Jacob Neusner and people like that, but I don't know enough to tell you. No, the idea of Shemitah from the rabbis doesn't mean that Shemitah doesn't originate in the Torah. It does originate in the Torah, of course. The question is, in the time of Rebbe, and perhaps even more so today, do we still keep Shemitah in the same way? Do we have the obligation to keep Shemitah like they did then? That's the issue. My email, I will send my email out right now. Hey, I called Rabbi Yeshua Levi Atana. I didn't mean that. It was a slip of my tongue. I apologize. And Amora. this is my email. I don't know if anybody else has questions, but tune in next week for our very last session before Pesach.
Thank you very much. I'll just point out one thing. I got it right here on my shelf. This is one introduction to Mishnah. I don't know if it's in English. Albech, Chanat Albech, Mavoli Mishnah. It's a more academic study. Epstein wrote a big book on the Mishnah. Avi Wolfish, who lives near you, usually. He's basically the literary style of the Mishnah, but he does fascinating work on the Mishnah. There is a academic, I forget the name of these two people in Israel who've, Safrai, I think, who put out a number of volumes.
Yes, Safrai is very important in terms of understanding archaeology and the reality of Eretz Israel in the Mishnah. Right. That's true, yeah. Also, very important.
Yeah. So there's a lot, and then there's all our traditional. Kahati, of course, I wouldn't exactly call that academic, but that's the modern Hebrew translation. That's, of course, all in English. I have it as an app on my phone. Hebrew and English, the Kahati Mishnah. But anyways, thoughts there. Thank you very much. You know, usually we look forward next week. We transition to Pesach, right? How they celebrated Pesach in the ancient time. Let's see the kalim they used and what the absorbs chametz, what doesn't absorb. I don't know what to say. We look forward. This evening, of course, our rotating Parsha Shir, Shira HaKoler from 9 to 9, will be giving the Shir this evening at 8:30. So everybody's welcome. We live in Israel. It'll be 3:30 next week. Shuli, don't forget, we changed the clock here, so it's going to be an hour earlier in Israel. It's going to be 1 p.m.
Oh, okay, that is great.
You know, I wrote to everybody. I may have forgotten to write to you. I apologize if I did that. If it's an issue, let me know. But hopefully it's 1 p.m. So I said, until I make Aliyah, we follow the Eastern, you know, time. And then,
all right, that is good to know.
Yeah. So next week it'll be 7 p.m. in Israel. I imagine this period, that was like the.
Okay, thank you. It would have been very silly to show really up an hour later. Okay, thank you, everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Have a Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Have a great day. Those around, terrific. We'll see you later tonight. Thanks.